Hey everyone, thanks so much for checking out the podcast. Today's a little different. We've got Simon Dingle. He is a local entrepreneur, and the first time I encountered Simon was on 5FM. It's a South African radio station, a national radio station. And the reason I was inspired to ask him to be on the podcast is because his segment on 5FM really inspired me to be a tech media person. And so it was really a pleasure to chat to him. I'm going to drop you in straight into the conversation, and this is Simon Dingle. Okay, well, before we get ahead of ourselves, let's just start, and you can tell people a little bit about yourself, who you are, and you know how you exist on the planet.
Cool. So my name's Simon. I'm currently in Cape Town, where the weather is absolutely superb for the first time in 3 weeks. It's been horrible. I'm an entrepreneur, gamer, runner, and incredibly bad surfer, and that's me in a nutshell.
okay cool. Well, that okay, they're already like, there's some similarities and interest there, because running, big into running. Okay, I'm not okay. A huge gamer. When I was listening to your podcast, I realized you way more into gaming than I am, and I grew up in Cape Town, so I still miss it. But okay, yeah, so let's quickly, so when I reached out to you, I like in my mind, my brain was locked into Simon Dingle, 5FM. And like, I was just, when you responded, I was like, well, this is so cool. The famous guy from 5FM, you know, cause I just, you know, those were the days where I really got to know you and got to know what you do. And then obviously reached out to you and have been updating myself on all the things that you do. But I haven't seen, have you seen anything about the retro gaming scene?
A little bit, yeah. So, you know, I grew up as a child of the 90s, I suppose. I was 9 years old when my dad brought his first computer home, which was an 8086, and got into DOS gaming. So my first exposure to gaming was
as we all did.
Like those really old, like almost ASCII art games like Hangman and... yes. But that very soon became Space Quest, you know, all of the Sierra games, Prince of Persia a little bit later. So, yeah, I mean, I was kind of a literal child in the 90s, and that was my exposure to gaming. And then I think I was about 12 years old when I got hold of a Nintendo Famicom. So that would be the South African equivalent or Japanese equivalent of the NES, the Nintendo Entertainment System. The original, of course, was the Famicom in Japan, and that was the version we got in South Africa, was the Japanese 8-bit Nintendo console. And that was my first console that I bought, and it just blew my mind. Like, my first cartridge was same. Super Mario Brothers. I'm still obsessed. Mm-hmm. My second cartridge was Goonies. So I had just enough money to get a Famicom with Super Mario Brothers and Goonies. And for the longest time, I just had those two games. And I was the happiest kid in the world with my Nintendo, my 8-bit Nintendo, and these two games. And that was my introduction to console gaming. But I suppose I've always been a little bit of a PC gamer at heart, because that was where it all started. Anyway, with retro gaming, because you know that's where I came from, I've got a nostalgia about those games. And so every now and then I'll load up DOSBox and play some old Sierra games. I recently played through Space Quest 1 and 2 again.
Crazy. And that's like super OG. Okay.
Yeah, giving away my age. But I also, you know, the Nintendo Switch has really great emulation built into it. So if you have a Nintendo online subscription.
Switch. Okay.
Yeah, if you've got a Nintendo online subscription, you get access to Game Boy, Nintendo Entertainment System, Super Nintendo, so the SNES, even Sega Mega Drive games, because I had a Mega Drive at one stage as a teenager. And you get access to a lot of those old games. The library isn't comprehensive, but all the stuff I want is there. And so I stopped using emulators and stuff for console gaming and started doing most of it on my Switch a while ago. That's where I'm at from a retro gaming perspective. I also am obsessed with 8-bit art. So every now and then I'll tweet out some screenshots from the games I'm playing.
I must keep an eye out for that. Yeah, so I'm exactly the same, actually. We were, I think we're a few years apart age-wise, and so we were just two young kids running around looking for a Famicom, because exactly the same. I must have been, it wasn't a lot, like $200 or whatever for a Famicom. They weren't very expensive. Back then, it was a fortune.
When would that have been? I feel like I was 12, so that would have been 1993, 4.
Yeah, maybe sounds about earlier. Right.
Yeah,
my perspective on time
definitely is hundreds of rands, so I can't remember. Inflation is a strange thing.
But the Famicom was amazing. I got into Darkwing Duck. So some of these games, like when you go back and you play them, they're just not as good as you remember. You know, like Prince of Persia is a great game, but then I put it on my emulator the other day, and I was like, this game is so weird. The mechanics are so odd. The way he like stops and then falls down a hole and then jumps and it's like so crazy.
But it's the same with everything. You know, there's a lot of music I used to listen to back then that was super cuck, actually. You know, and you have this nostalgia about TV shows. Like, I don't know if you've tried to rewatch MacGyver. You probably remember MacGyver from when we were growing up. Like, I have this incredible nostalgia about these TV shows. And you're oh, it was amazing. And then you go and watch it and you're like, oh, wow, that definitely wasn't amazing. But, you know, time and place and... So what's truly incredible to me is when you come across something that really was amazing, like The Princess Bride. You're like, oh, wow. No, this movie is objectively the coolest thing ever. Or a game like Super Mario Brothers, you're like, or Tetris. You're like, like this thing was amazing then, and it's even more amazing now. Like, it's just, you know, it's cool to test that every now and then and go, oh, no, this thing that I was obsessed with when I was 15 was actually incredibly bad. But so not all of it was.
So my channel, because I'm putting this on YouTube, is all about these little things. So I don't know if you've seen these. They're these little emulator consoles coming out of China. Yeah. And
copyright nightmare.
So one of the... it's interesting. I was chatting to one of the big guys that's like his channel blew up doing all of this, and I don't know, like anything, I think it is kind of also pushing the handheld console industry forward. So you know, like, because there's a bit of a crossover now between Linux, Android, and PC gaming on a handheld.
Yes. And iOS, which is a formidable ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Do you like gaming on iOS?
I really do, because, you know, for all of Apple's shortcomings, their vertical integration and controlling the entire hardware stack means that they've got more beef in their devices than... So, I mean, if you look at the new iPhone 15 Pro, you can say whatever you want about Apple, but just purely at a... I mean, you've got 3-nanometer chips... You've got, I don't know how many GPU cores they're up to now. Like, you know, there's some things in the Android world that come close, but nothing really from a raw power perspective. And now that they've switched to USB-C, you can pair an Xbox controller with it. You can plug in an HDMI port. You can power it. And you've got a pretty compelling console, you know, in your phone, which is amazing. And of course, you can do the stuff with Android devices as well. But I feel like the developers aren't quite there. So, you know, there are a few really great console-like experiences on on iOS, like Brawlhalla, for example. So the developers haven't shown up in numbers yet, but the hardware's there, and it's if nothing else, that's impressive.
Yeah, but I don't know. Have we not been saying that for a while, and it never gets there? You know.
I think if you're a game developer, you probably want as much reach as you can get. And, you know, being native on a platform like iOS takes a lot of resources. Mm. And so if you're going to choose an ecosystem, you're going to go wherever you can, you know, get the biggest audience, the biggest bang for your buck.
Yeah.
Nintendo has somehow compelled indie developers onto the Switch in a massive way, which surprised me.
Apple hasn't
quite cracked it. Although it is quite telling that iOS is the only other ecosystem that Nintendo develops for.
That is interesting. Yeah, that is
like
a good
point.
Like
you can get Mario Kart on your iPhone. You can't get it on any other device that isn't a Nintendo.
Yeah, but again, I tried it and I don't know. is it consoleable? Like because I played it and I was like, this is, I don't know. It felt janky and I just gave up.
I think the best gaming experience I've had on mobiles and especially touchscreens of late was Diablo, is it Immortal? That, like, you know, and it's very loot boxy and pay to win and whatever, but
yeah,
you can get pretty far without spending any money on it. And Blizzard has really delivered a very compelling gaming experience with touchscreen controls,
yeah,
which I was never a fan of. And you can link a controller if you want and use like a
Bluetooth
or Xbox or...
Yeah, interesting, because I read the reviews on it and they weren't very good, so I kind of just left it.
I think it's because the reviews came from hardcore Diablo fans that are used to the full-on PC experience of Diablo 3 and now 4, and they were never going to like it. That it's not a game for them.
Yeah.
So, and they're obviously going to be the most vocal critics of anything Blizzard does on mobile. But if you just look at it objectively... Yeah. I was expecting to hate it and was pleasantly surprised. It's an amazing game. I mean, I hate the loot boxy stuff and, you know.
Yeah.
But I had enough fun without having to do any of that stuff.
Yeah, like the way Asphalt 9 went and all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of does. I don't know. But I've never been a hardcore gamer. So for me, this whole like retro scene really appeals to me because, I don't know. Like, you know, Super Mario, you pick it up. Play for, I don't know, I think my maximum play time is like half an hour and then save states and I move on, you know. So the retro games are good for me.
Well, it wasn't as games weren't designed to be a casino in your pocket back then, and they are now. You know, like gaming experiences, especially on mobile now, are designed to just suck as much money out of you for skins and weapons and I hate that. And gamers are also a strange bunch at the moment. They love, for some reason, these big AAA series studios that just take as much of their money as possible. They hate open source projects and NFTs that are trying to liberate them from that reality for some reason that has to do with the planet, I think, even though Ethereum is now proof of stake and uses almost no electricity, but whatever. Like, I find it very hard to gel with modern gaming culture. A lot of Siri's just chimed in there. Shut up, Siri. God. You know, you put your phone on do not disturb, but Siri doesn't pay attention. Sorry about that.
No.
but anyway, I mean, back to my original point. I think there's just that pure joy of retro gaming where there's nothing to buy. They're not trying to upsell you on anything.
I
there isn't
it.
An experience to unlock. There's no downloadable content. You can pause at any time and walk away. It's not trying to hold your attention. And, you know, the most competitive thing in Mario, the original Super Mario, is just to see how many points you can get, kind of. But you don't even really care about that. You know, you just want to see how far you can get on your original three lives. And it's just the pure joy of playing a game without, you know, being asked for a coin or... whatever else.
Yeah, so you're still a Mario fan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because it's where I was in, you know, I was 12 going on 13 when I discovered Super Mario Brothers, so very formative time, lots of memories from back then, very concrete memories, you know, that start forming at that age that you don't have before then, really.
Yes. So
it'll always be... It's nostalgia. It's also one of the silliest things human beings have ever made. Like, it's a Japanese game studio that made a game about an Italian plumber who gets hunted by mushrooms.
So much cultural appropriation.
You know,
I think
it's
about
like,
that. Yeah.
It's bizarre. But yeah, I've been planning to get a Mario tattoo for many years. I think it's actually time to do it. Because
it's time, man. It's time.
Yeah, it was just the pure joy of it and the art, which was amazing. you know, I love the whole story of Nintendo as well, that it's a company that was formed in the 19th century to make Hanafuda playing cards in Japan, and how the company evolved over the years.
Yes, playing cards, yeah.
And how its culture evolved, and then it eventually became famous for a game about an Italian plumber. I mean, we could get very philosophical about humanity and use Mario as the word I'm looking for. Yeah, you know, whatever. Yeah. I could talk about Super Mario all day and about Nintendo, but yeah, it's I'll always love Mario. And also what you were saying earlier, it's one of the few games from that era that still is great. Like, I pick up the original Super Mario Brothers today.
It's still fantastic.
And myself and my girlfriend will do this every now and then. We'll just dive into Super Mario Brothers, and it's like, this game's amazing. Let's see how far we can get. Oh, like, there's an extra life here that we didn't know about. And it just, yeah, it's still fun. It's still amazing.
Well, that, I think that therein lies the secret in Mario, because there are so many hidden layers. So no matter how many times you play it, you always find something new, which is really amazing. But my experience of Mario was, so I was just locked into the NES version of Super Mario, like the original old OG Super Mario number one, you know? I don't even think I played Super Mario 3 that much. And so now, getting into retro gaming, I'm busy playing through the 3DS version, and my mind's just blown.
It's amazing
how they evolved this game. It's just incredible. The graphics, his movements, everything's just so, like, the way the music plays and all the characters go, you know, when the music goes da 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 da, and all the characters on the screen like dance with you. It's
those little touches.
I don't know. I just love it.
And also things they did, like Paper Mario. I don't know if you ever played Paper Mario, but
I tried it out because someone on my YouTube channel recommended it, and I gave it a go.
Like Nintendo just does things that nobody else would think of. You know, it's like these bizarre ideas that just somehow work, and
just crazy things.
Yeah. So is Mario also that game for you? Like, if you think back to your intro to gaming.
Yes, totally. It just takes me back. No matter how many times I play it, I just get the feels, you know? Definitely.
That and Space Quest.
You talked about, like, formative memories. It's almost like core memories that I built around. I mentioned in another episode is Darkwing Duck. Someone gave me the Darkwing Duck cartridge for my birthday or whatever, and I played it like so many times through. Not such a difficult game, but every single time I pick it up, it takes me right back to my parents' lounge, sitting there supposed to be doing homework, and then, like, you know, the 15 minutes before my mom gets home, pack it away, make sure she doesn't realize that, and then put all my books out, you know. It's just such good memories.
Yeah. I think the other big memory I have from that era was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game, the first one. It was the first, like, proper four-player experience I ever had. So you could have, you know, four mates if you had enough remotes. It was based on the arcade game, I think.
Didn't it come on the Genesis, the Sega?
Yeah. So there was a NES version of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, if I'm remembering correctly. But, yeah, just a fantastic game. And then text-based adventures. Absolutely love text-based adventures as well.
Text-based adventures.
So a little bit beyond pure text.
I can't get into that.
Like the Space Quests and the Police Quests and the Indiana Joneses and the Look Room.
Yeah.
You know, walk over here and try and find the right command to put in. I'm not sure what it was about those games. Maybe it's just because I was really young and it was the first thing that I, you know, Leisure Suit Larry and Search for the King and they were frustrating as hell. You know, you at some point you needed a cheat book or you needed to find a friend who had done this. This was before the internet, so you couldn't Google it.
Before Google.
And you were just on your own, you know. So I got Space Quest from a friend of mine, but he only had the first disc, so it was on two discs. And at one point you're in this cave and you get to this laser. Spoiler alert, you have to put a piece of glass into the laser and then it like melts down and you can cross. And the moment you do that, it says, please insert disc two. And my little brother and I had spent months like trying to figure out, I mean, I think I was 9 or 10 years old, like trying to figure out after months we had figured out how to get to this point in the laser and it was like, please insert disc two. And we're like, cool. We don't have disc two.
Oh my gosh.
what now?
Did you guys eventually get it, or did you just live in limbo for the rest of your life?
Yeah, years later, we found somebody that had Disc 2 of Space Quest and managed to finish it.
Crazy.
Yeah, different times.
Yeah, it is good. And I think that's where just, the secret sauce is with why these consoles are doing so well, these little emulators, is all these memories. You know, it's not necessarily hardcore gamers. It's just guys that want to have the feels from the olden days, you know.
Really, I also cool. see a lot of parents buying them for little kids because, I mean, the thing now is, you know, you stick an iPad in front of your kid and they're, you know, busy all day. But the iPad's connected to the internet. There's stuff popping up all the time. All the games are casinos in your pocket. And I've seen a lot of, you know, friends and people I've met traveling that will buy these retro gaming consoles that have like 100, you know, old 8-bit games and just give that to their kid because they're not worried about them meeting strangers online or accidentally hitting something that's going to cost $100 or, you know, it's just simple, easy, fun.
Yeah.
It's safe. You can take it away anytime, you know?
Yeah, it's true because I tried to get my kids into it because my daughter's into Roblox and like I don't know how to get out of it because it's just, I don't know. They're all into that. All the kids go on and they play together.
No, good luck, dude.
Oh.
No, my kids went through the Roblox thing as well when they're a little bit younger. And
okay.
I mean, Roblox is incredible. Mm. Between Roblox and Minecraft, I mean, gaming to this generation means something that completely different to what it means to our generation.
Mm. It is very foreign.
I think
to
Minecraft
me.
is the modern day Lego. I think Minecraft is more to kids today like Lego was to us growing up. It's just this artifact of childhood.
Mm.
There's no point to it. You just build whatever you want and it's, you know, amazing, but I don't fully get it.
No, me either. It's like foreign. Yeah. Maybe we should switch gears and talk a little bit. Like, I mean, you've done so many things. You know, like I say, I was excited to have the guy that I heard on 5FM years ago and then realize, you know, you've done so many things. So let's do like a bit of like an arch of what you've been into and then kind of, you know, get into it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I suppose 5FM was something I did on the side for 10 years. Mm. Apparently, it was the longest running non-tech feature on the radio station on 5FM. Mm. Sorry, non-music feature.
Yeah.
It really came from my relationship with the original hosts of the lunch show on 5FM, Grant and Anele. We were all together at Tux FM, which was our campus radio station. Mm. You know, I at the time was working mostly in print journalism. So I was writing columns for magazines and that sort of thing.
Yes, articles. I remember that, yeah.
And doing radio on the side. So I was on 702 and Cape Talk for a while, which are talk radio stations here in South Africa. And I was enjoying it and learning a lot, but not liking the organization behind it and also finding it very rigid and it didn't really suit my lifestyle. Basically decided that talk radio wasn't for me, but music radio wasn't entirely either. And I was like, well, what I want to do is just talk about technology because that's my hobby and my favorite thing.
Yeah.
And I phoned up Anele, my daughter, who is one of the most formidable talents this country has ever seen, especially in radio, but in a lot of other ways too. And I was like, Anele, I'm tired of talk radio. I want to do something about technology. Maybe we should do it on your show. And she was like, I'm in.
Cool.
She was like, come to 5FM. I'll tell them that we're going to do this thing and let's just do it.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
That's how it started. So it was just me chasing my bliss and having friends in the right place to make it happen. And yeah, there was 10 years of a lot of fun. I mean, look, it was 15 or 20 minutes on the radio once a week. So it wasn't anything major, but it was fun. And in the background, I had discovered...
Yeah, it impacted me, man.
It's lovely to hear. You know, I meet people because of the radio show all the time, and it's just pure joy. Mm. But, you know, you're not going to earn a living off of 20 minutes on radio once a week. So in the background, I was embarking on a career in fintech. I had discovered Bitcoin in 2010. Mm. I'd always been a tech guy, like...
Jeez.
complete Linux and open source geek back then, like just obsessed with open source, and actually did some work with Go Open Source when Mark Shuttleworth launched it in South Africa. Through my friend Craig Rodney, we did work on Novell and Oracle and some of the big open source sort of enterprise software providers. But ended up writing for about technology, but for financial publications like Finweek and Financial Times.
All right.
And then eventually kind of found this intersection of a world I didn't know a lot about, which was money and finance, and a world I knew a whole lot about, which was open source technology and networking. And and I was like, this, you know, this Bitcoin thing is mind blowing. You know, if I think about it from a network science perspective, never mind the economics. And so just became enamored with financial technology because of Bitcoin. So this would have been 2010-11. And yeah, had a very kind of chaotic following my nose career through developing fintech and working on projects like Luno, what was BitX back then when I was part of it. And yeah, learning, I mean, I understood technology, or I had a pretty good understanding of technology, knew nothing about the world of finance and economics and stuff, had to learn that and piece them together. And and that's turned into my career. So radio has always been a passion, but unfortunately not the headline.
Yeah, like I say, it definitely influenced me, because I've always had, I mean, I have a very different trajectory in my life, but always had a passion for this. And so I'm very excited that it's slowly but surely taking off. And one of the things was, like your little segment on 5FM impacted me, I must say. Like I really was, I think it was excitement to see a South African who was so into tech and knew so much about tech, you know, because up until that point, I'd only seen people from overseas that were as passionate and as informed, you know?
Yeah, I have to shout out Leo Laporte, because he was a big part of my journey in tech broadcasting. I discovered This Week in Tech in 2000, and when did it launch? 4 or 5, I think. You know, podcasting was a new idea then. And I just immediately loved it because I was missing live radio and I hadn't done it for a while. This was before 5FM and stuff. And this idea of, I mean, it's such an amazing thing that you can, anybody can make content and you don't need permission. You can just put it online and, you know, maybe two people will watch it, or maybe 100 or 1,000 or, but I discovered Leo in those early days of podcasting. And, you know, he had this incredible career on tech TV in the States. He's this larger than life personality, and he was living my dream, which was just, you know, talking about technology all day at scale. And I actually reached out to him. Well, it was actually through his producer, Dane Golden, at the time. And, Leo is just this incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for? Like he's just so giving, and he answered my messages on Twitter. I DM'd him, eventually I ended up on his podcast on This Week in Tech. I mean, it was Super Bowl Sunday, and like nobody else was available, so that was the only reason he let me on, I think. but I ended up doing I ended up doing a few broadcasts on his network, and I was lucky enough at the time that because I was writing about technology and reporting on technology, technology companies would send me to junkets and conferences, so they'd pay for me to go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas and conferences in San Francisco, and so I actually got to meet Leo in person and have dinner with him and his team, and and met Tom Merritt through him, who now does DTNS, Daily Tech News Show. I hope I got that right. And Tom has also just been so incredibly supportive, and so really Leo and Tom gave me that leg up to go, okay, I love what I'm doing in the podcasting world with these guys, but I think there's something I could do on local radio in South Africa that'll scratch my live FM radio itch as well, and launch my radio show, which, to be honest, is similar to what I think Leo still has, his live radio show, the tech guy. which is a call-in show where people phone in with technology questions. His is a far more elaborate version because it's a full-on radio show. It's not just 20 minutes in somebody else's show like mine was.
Yeah.
But so, you know, he really was a big inspiration for that and a big reason that I was able to do it. And I think that the lesson was that that whatever it is you want to do, the support is there. And it's amazing how willing people are to help if you just reach out, if you just ask, you know. I never in a million years thought Leo would ever get back to me, but he did. And I ended up on his show. Mm. But I had to ask, you know, I just had to put myself out there. And
exactly.
And when you ask the world a question, it's going to give you an answer. You might not like the answer, but you'll get one. And if you never ask, you'll never know, which is sad.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, this thing that I'm doing now is very similar. I mean, yourself and the previous guy I had on the show, he's the biggest guy in the emulation retro handheld space. And he was like, yeah, cool, let's do it, man. And I'm like, 10,000 subscribers. He's like 320,000 subscribers. And he was like, cool, let's do this thing. Yeah. So yeah, like you're totally right. So I wanted to jump into the crypto thing. Like I say, I want to jump into the crypto thing. Mm-hmm. I have zero clue. Crypto came along and I was like, I don't understand. Like I'm into tech, but I'm also creative. And I don't know, numbers, very bad with numbers. I did well at maths at school, but I don't know. Like my wife does the numbers. So I was curious when you said it's you're working on certain crypto things, and the one thing you spoke about was a stable currency, specifically in Africa. Could you maybe explain that a bit?
Yeah. So it's been interesting being in crypto over the last 12 years, give or take, in that we go through these waves where, as with any new technology, it goes through hype cycles, but it goes through periods like it is right now where people think it's dead and it's over and nobody's doing anything with it.
Yeah.
And that couldn't be further from the truth. Like crypto is starting to really make inroads from a regulatory perspective. Big institutions like Visa and MasterCard are adopting it. There's very big news on the way over the next 2 years. And so crypto is anything but dead. Mm. It's just manifesting in a way that nobody expected. Similarly to what Linux did. You know, we all thought Linux was going to win when I was obsessed with it in the early days. We didn't think it was going to become the dominant mobile operating system in the form of Android because we didn't have smartphones, you know. And so crypto is taking on a life of its own. And the primary use case that's emerging for crypto is stablecoins. And so stablecoins are crypto assets like Bitcoin or Ethereum, which most people will have heard of, except that they're pegged to the price of a real world currency. So the biggest stablecoin in the world is called Tether. Its ticker is USDT, and it's pegged to the price of the dollar. So one Tether token is always worth $1 if it's doing its job properly. So unlike Bitcoin and Ethereum, where the price is volatile and it's worth this much today and that much tomorrow and it spikes and it dips, stablecoins should be, as the name suggests, stable. Their price should never change. They should always be worth $1 or $1 or whatever they're pegged to. And so my project is ZOP, which is a stablecoin for the rand. I think important things to know about stablecoins, firstly, is that they're not currency. They're tokens that represent a currency. A little bit like an IOU note. Mm-hmm. You know, if I give you a 10 Rand note or an IOU for 10 Rand, you know, that thing itself isn't really money because it wasn't issued by a central bank, but you can go and get 10 Rand for it. So it represents that value.
Yes.
And so stable coins represent the value of real world currencies or fiat currencies, as we call them, on the blockchain or in these networks. Mm-hmm. They can be used for payments. And the reason you'd want to do that is because you have all the leverage of money built for the internet. So they're faster, they're cheaper, they're permissionless. You don't need a bank account to use them. Okay. You just need a wallet, which can be an app.
All right.
And so that's really the biggest use case for crypto assets at the moment. And it's a fascination of mine because I'm obsessed with open source and open networks and permissionless access. Mm. Which I think the world needs more of. And so that's why the obsession with crypto, but very specifically with something like SARP, which is usable, you know, has real tangible use cases, is simple to understand and can make a big difference in the world, and isn't prone to the kind of gambling, speculation, and all the, not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, a lot of the attention that crypto gets is people trying to get rich overnight. Stablecoins are not about that. Stablecoins are about living your life and paying for things and earning a salary and all the, you know, all the very real needs that we have, where our traditional currencies did a fine job and continue to do a fine job and aren't going to go anywhere, but now can have superpowers with this new technology that makes them faster, cheaper, more accessible, fairer, all that good stuff.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, and well, I mean, I suppose in Africa, that takes on a whole different meaning in terms of, you know, people crossing borders and just the access to money.
Yeah, so there are a few things to think about. Firstly, one has to be very careful because Africa is not a country, you know, it's it's many countries and it's 1.2 billion people. And, you know, it's very easy to kind of generalize and there are some commonalities. But, you know, if you look at a country like Kenya versus South Africa versus Namibia versus Nigeria, these are all extremely different places, wildly different, different economies, different languages, different cultures, different religions. And that's interesting. But I think if one looks at emerging markets more broadly, whether in Africa or South America or elsewhere, there's some commonalities. The one thing you have is a large kind of migrant workforce. So in our example, people from places like Zimbabwe coming to South Africa because they perceive greater economic opportunity here and sending money back home.
Yeah.
So that remittance back to families in another country or whatever, you know, those are some of the biggest remittance corridors in the world, are people who have been forced to leave their home because they need to work somewhere else, but they need to send money back home. And massive use cases there for crypto. And we're seeing adoption at scale of crypto for those use cases. Because before, these people would be exploited by companies that would stand as middlemen and charge exorbitant fees. I mean, it's quite crazy when you look at how badly these people would be ripped off. You know, in the worst cases, if you sent money from South Africa to Zimbabwe, by the time it arrived in Zimbabwe, you could have lost up to 60% of the value just in fees and spreads and dishonesty, quite frankly, in the middlemen that facilitated these payments. With crypto, you don't lose any of that value. If I buy a dollar stablecoin in South Africa like Tether, firstly, I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not circumventing foreign exchange control because I'm not buying a currency. I'm buying an asset that represents that value. I can send it to my family in Zimbabwe. It'll arrive in seconds, not minutes, not hours, not days, seconds. And there will be a fee, but it'll be so small that I won't notice it depending on which crypto rails I'm using. Let's say I'm using Solana. The price will be a fraction of a cent. And so there immediately is a massive advantage for a lot of people in the world, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions. The other big angle that I'm quite passionate about is financial inclusion. There are a lot of people that are excluded from the global economy because, frankly, traditional banks don't want them as clients. You know, bank accounts are expensive. You can't get a bank account that does anything useful. I mean, it's getting better. We've got banks now in South Africa that you've got like Bank Zero, where there are no fees for having a bank account, etc. So it's not all banks. But there are other reasons why these people don't easily get bank accounts. One of them is that banks have to comply with regulation like FICA for very good reason. You know, they have to do KYC on their customers. They need to know that you're a real person, that you are who you say you are. So they need your ID book, they need your proof of address. But those things that are trivial for somebody living in a big city or suburbia to fulfill, middle-class people basically, are very difficult to fulfill for a lot of the country. A proof of address is non-trivial if you're living in some township areas or rural areas. So getting a bank account is not easy for these people. And the stats is that in South Africa, there's somewhere around 8 million people, depending who you ask, who are, you know, adults who are economically active but do not have bank accounts. And so the banks have tried to deliver products to them like e-wallets and, you know, mobile money things, and those are fine. But crypto presents these people with an interesting opportunity to become economically active on the internet without having to qualify. So the blockchain doesn't care who you are. It doesn't need your ID and your proof of address. It's moved beyond that because it's cryptographically secured. It doesn't care how much money you have. You know, a Bitcoin wallet doesn't care if you have R1 or $1 million in it. It's going to treat you the same way. So there's a equanimity in blockchain technology that is exciting from a financial inclusion angle and getting people online and participating, you know, globally, potentially being able to pay for things that we take for granted, like apps and access and entertainment. And also to do the money things that they were doing in the past in a better way. So if you look at credit unions, which we call stokvels in South Africa, that's something you find in every single country, right? You find it in India. You find it all over South America. You find it in emerging markets, developed countries. Credit unions are a beautiful thing that communities do to help each other out financially. But in the past, there haven't really been financial products for it. You know, a lot of stokvels, especially in South Africa, are run on cash, which is a big risk for the person who's looking after all of the community's money. They get robbed, cash can burn, you know, there are all sorts of things that can happen to physical money. Managing it is a nightmare, you know, making sure that everything's handled fairly and keeping the accounts, whereas all of that stuff can happen. You can set up a multi-sig wallet on the blockchain. Multi-sig means that you need a quorum of signatures before a transaction can happen. So you can set up a Bitcoin wallet and say these 10 people all have keys for this wallet and 8 of the 10 have to agree to any transaction before it'll happen. So nobody can, no single person can go and take the money. And so that's a beautiful, powerful tool for a credit union or a stokvel to use, that's going to cost them nothing, that is free to access. They can set it up in seconds. There's no more cash in the system. It's fair. The community can use it as a tool. So, I mean, as you can tell, I could carry on all day about this, but there's so many real use cases in emerging markets and in my home country of South Africa that blockchain just delivers these efficiencies to. Better, faster, fairer, cheaper. It's just better in every way. But unfortunately, the PR around crypto is terrible because we're so enamored with what comes out of North America on all fronts. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people think crypto is just scams, and they think about it in a weirdly different way. You know, like, so one of my favorite examples is, by all accounts, and there's been research done on this, at least 95% of all emails sent is spam. It's somebody trying to steal your money, basically. 95%.
Yeah.
That's optimistic. It's probably closer to 98% of all emails sent is spam. But people don't go, oh, well, you know, we need to stop using email because clearly this is a terrible technology and it's only being used by criminals. No, that 1 or 2% of useful email makes, you know, the 98% of spam worthwhile. And so the same is true of all technology. And so when I look at crypto, I'm like, yes, you know, a lot of it is, let's say 95% of it is nonsense and scams and people trying to steal your money. Fine. It doesn't matter because it's worth it for the 5% that is changing people's lives and making things fair and making life in a place like Zimbabwe tenable for a lot of people. Now, I recently spoke to a farmer in Zimbabwe, and he said to me, if it wasn't for Bitcoin, I wouldn't be able to stay in my country. There is no banking system left.
Not, crazy, man.
You know, our currency is worth nothing. Everybody's using dollars, but you kind of have to work with it in cash, which is impossible, especially if you're running a farm or an organization of any meaningful size. He's like, so Bitcoin's my bank now. Yeah. It's how I pay for my tractors. It's how I store my wealth. It's how I get paid for my produce. Yeah. You know, so I'm like, I look at all these people who think Bitcoin's a flash in the pan and it's going away, and I'm like, wipe the crap from your eyes and just look at what's happening in the real world. Like, this is changing lives, and there's a very wholesome thing that's happening here. And if you just move beyond the bad PR and the FUD and the nonsense that's been spread, quite frankly, about wasting electricity and gamers' misunderstanding of NFTs, like, there's so much good stuff happening here.
Yeah, no, you've definitely, yeah, I want to look into it more because, you know, I think the main reason I asked you is because I see people struggling with the facilities they have available to them to just use money on a daily basis. You know, just people I deal with on a every day, and they have to constantly have cash with them because they don't know how else to manage their lives. So, yeah. It's interesting.
It's simple to me. It's the march of technology. There was nothing wrong with VHS or Betamax or, you know, stiffy discs. Or it's just we've got something better now. No, but you know what I mean. It's like,
yeah,
I'm not going to go back to my DVD player. I've got Netflix now. Thank you. And experientially, exactly. More and more people are getting there with money. They're going, guys, I've got an incredible piece of software like Phantom on the Solana network. I've got dollars there that I can send to anybody in the world in a second for a fraction of a cent. Like, there was nothing wrong with my bank. There was nothing wrong with the way money worked before. It's better now. Sorry, this is better. So I'm going to, is what I'm doing. There are millions of other people doing it. You can poo-poo it and choose to fight it, but we're doing this now. Sorry, it's better. We're not going to stop doing it. So deal with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Thanks for enlightening me.
Hey, you're going to find, for every one of me, you're going to find 100 critics of crypto, so brace yourself.
but it's great. I'm sure we'll get some comments, but it's just great. You know, we need positive people to get these things out there.
Yeah, I think that's part of my point is I find cynicism extremely intellectually lazy because it's so easy. You know, we live in a universe of entropy. Everything is spiraling towards itself.
Agree, man.
So you can sit back and go, well, that doesn't work and that should, yes, the world's full of problems. Well done. Here's your gold star. But the people who make things better, who fight entropy, who, you know, make this a livable place, who give you lights to turn on and toilets that flush are the optimists. And it's hard being an optimist because everything is, you know, breaking or broken. And so those are my people. Like cynics are just intellectually lazy, like whatever. Yes, it's important to identify problems. Well done. But it's not difficult.
Yeah. It's mostly our age group. I tell you, if I Google something remotely cynical or I end up, my YouTube's just flooded with conspiracy and bullshit. And then I just have, I don't know, I'll go watch something more interesting.
Yeah.
Like fix my algorithm.
And Trump fans.
It's crazy.
And
like
anti-vaxxers and.
Yeah. People around 40 years old. Like, I don't know. I don't know what happened to us, but yeah.
It actually blows my mind because it is an age thing to some degree. And, you know, there's an example I'm thinking of, and obviously I won't mention their name on Twitter, you know, who was very progressive in his 20s and, you know, was fighting the power and change the world. And you know, he posted this long rant about NFTs and gaming and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, basically all I'm hearing you say is you're old and you don't understand the world, just like your parents didn't understand what the kids were doing and you got frustrated with them. And now, congratulations, you become your parents. You become an old cynical naysayer. Well done. Like, that's all I've learned from this thread.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I grew up pretty conservative, like religious and all that stuff. And then I swung pretty far to the right. Where? Which one is the liberal? Left.
Left.
And then I've kind of, now I'm at a point where I'm like, everything's just gray.
Yes.
There's just the middle ground. I was listening to your podcast and I really resonated with something you said. You said, anything that's extreme is usually wrong, you know?
Yes.
Because we are living in a world of extremism.
I really do believe that. I'm yet to think of an example of an extreme view that's been proven correct by history. And the interesting thing about extremism is that you almost always end up in the same place, which is a cult. If you go extreme left-wing politics or extreme right-wing politics, you end up with fascism in both ways, you know?
Yeah. Either way. Yeah, totally.
You end up with a fascist mindset that I'm right and the rest of the world is wrong and everybody must conform to my point of view, otherwise they're going to whatever my version of hell is, and And that extremism is extremely dangerous. So actually, maybe the only extreme view is that's correct is my extreme view that extremism is always wrong.
Well, that took a turn.
I could play this game all day.
That flipped on us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, you're preaching to the choir because I ended up in almost a cult environment, and it was just extreme views, extreme everything, and now I'm just in a world of, not confusion, a world of just find the middle ground, you know?
Yeah, and I think one has to be careful when you find yourself in an environment where there are unfalsifiable hypotheses and you just have to trust someone. And that's usually when you know you're on the wrong path. Is trust me, you don't understand the world. I do. I know something absolute that I can't prove to you, but you just have to believe me that it's true because I say so. And that's usually when you're in for disaster. We're heading towards it.
Yeah, I've been there.
Unless it's that Super Mario Brothers is the greatest console game ever made, because then they're just right.
Yeah. That's the next episode. We'll just talk about Super Mario and like the finer details of the graphics and the hidden worlds and all that stuff.
Yes,
I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a blast, and you can tell your friend Sam that you guys need to keep going with the podcast because you have one like a solid viewer. Listener, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, Sam and I are the most disorganized podcasters in history, but we have been doing a very poor job of our podcast for 10 years, and that's something, I suppose. I think there'd be more the years than episodes we've put out, but whatever.
I think you guys are hilarious. I really enjoy it.
Thank you. It's, you know, like I was saying to you before we started recording, Take Back the Days is my excuse to hang out with Sam online. You know, she moved to London a while ago, and I'm still spending most of my time in Cape Town. And I miss the living hell out of her. And so the podcast was like, you know, a way for us to go, okay, we have to hang out online. Because I think it was interesting during the pandemic, as a complete digression, how we did these things. Like I would FaceTime my friend Robin in Berlin and we'd have dinner together. So she'd be having dinner in Berlin and I'd be in Cape Town and we'd hang out online. Or, you know, I spent more time calling my parents and my siblings and it's like, and then the pandemic ended and we stopped doing that stuff. But I'm like, why? You know, Robin still lives in Berlin. My parents still live in another city. Like, why don't we do that stuff all the time? You know, Sam and I made a real effort to hang out online and play games. You know, we were playing Don't Starve, I think, which is great. Don't Starve together.
Okay, cool.
And like making an effort to kind of call each other and do our podcast. And then the pandemic ended and we all just snapped back. And so I guess my point is, like, you get stuck in your daily life and, you know, you kind of have this myopic view of whatever's in front of you at the moment, and whoever else is not around isn't around. And so starting the podcast, I think, was a way for me and Sam to kind of disrupt that pattern and go, no, we're going to hang out now, you know, and then proceeded to do a very poor job of keeping any sort of schedule around that, but whatever.
Well, I listened to two episodes and you guys seem to divulge into socialism very quickly. It was quite funny.
Yeah, I think we had probably both just watched Triangle of Sadness, so it was topical.
Okay, cool. No, I don't know. It spoke to me. It was good.
Good.
Cool.
Well, I'm glad we've got at least one listener.
No, I'm into it.
You and my mom, actually, too.
Yeah, I appreciate your info on crypto. Oh, cool. Yeah. No, it's hilarious. I honestly think if you guys could bring on guests and talk shit, it would do well. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what your listenership's like, but...
Neither do I. I'm sure there's stats somewhere I could look up. Like I said, it's just a pure joy to hang out with Sam and chat. And, you know, she's just such an incredible human being and has such an amazing career. And, you know, she just put out her first novel, The Girls of Little Hope. It's just such an amazing book. And her nonfiction, you know, her first book, How to Manage Your Money Like an Effing Grown Up, is just a perennial bestseller. And, you know, it's just, she's one of those people that everything she does, she just puts her whole heart and soul into, and you can see it and feel it. And because she's just so much better at everything than I am, I just like hanging out with her and hoping some of it rubs off.
That's the way you do it, man. Yeah. Yeah. Hang out with people that are better than you.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Simon. I'll put the links, because we didn't even talk about it. The links to your books, I'll put the Amazon links cool. In the show notes and in the description on YouTube.
Mm. Yeah, please don't stress about it.
Well, you've got a pretty comprehensive book about crypto. So, I mean, you went deep into that. So, I'll put the book there.
Yeah. So there were two. The first book I did was In Math We Trust, which I was approached by Tracy McDonald, amazing publisher in South Africa. And I'm so glad she did, because writing that book was a real journey. And then the second book I did with my friend Stephen Sidley, we co-wrote a book called Beyond Bitcoin, about decentralized finance and sort of all the stuff, other stuff that's happened since. And so both available on Amazon as ebooks. Beyond Bitcoin's available in print all over the world, I think. It's also available in Korean and Arabic and a few other languages.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so... I guess those are my thoughts on crypto in print form. But because it's such a fast moving field and industry, you know, you kind of write a book and by the time it goes to print, it's already outdated. But I think especially in Math We Trust, managed to capture my view on the world of money. The interesting thing about books is I used to be a blogger, and I loved the fact that I could go and edit my blog post later if I changed my mind about something, you know, spotted a mistake.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing about books is, you know, they're just out there, and then that's the way it is, and you can't go and change it after the fact. So I might have to do another one, because I think I've changed my mind about a few of the things I used to think back then, but also can't remember exactly what I wrote, so I'll have to go
interesting check. Read your own book. I disagree with that's me. Cool.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, man. It was an absolute
thanks so much.
Pleasure talking about retro games on a podcast, which I don't think I've ever had the pleasure of doing before.
Cool. Yeah, it's a whole world, man. But, I mean, you say you're playing retro games on your Switch, so I don't think you'd have any interest in getting one of these. I'm busy. A client asked me today to set one up for him, so I'm going to order one from China and set it all up for him.
Which one would you recommend getting?
Either Linux or Android. The Retroid Pocket 3 Plus is my favorite right now.
Okay. What do they go for?
That one it's $150.
Okay.
But the shipping is ridiculous. Right. It's like $60 shipping.
So there's no local distributor for them.
But it gets to you in like 5 days.
Right.
To South Africa.
Okay. And then when you say running Linux, does the device come clean and you kind of have to install your own operating system, or?
No. So, that's why this little YouTube world is growing, because there's so many little options, and some of it isn't working so well, some of it is working. I mean, in the olden days, they just arrived to you broken. You'd have to just fix it. But now, like this one that just arrived, whoops.
And what's it's running cool under the hood? Is it like Raspberry Pi kind of hardware, or?
Oh, it's a T618 chip. I think it's made by MediaTek.
Is it ARM, I think?
But it's an Android. It's an ARM-based chip.
Yeah. Okay.
And it comes with a pretty decent Android build, but the Android ones are a bit of a mission. Like this friend of mine, a client of mine, said to me, like, you should just start a business setting these up for people, which I don't know about that, but it is a bit of a mission.
No. So what do you recommend setting it up with?
So it comes with Android, but then you need to put a front end on. So there's a really good front end made by a dev. So you've got your emulators. Yeah, we should have gotten into this at the beginning of the podcast. But you've got your emulators, but then you get a front end that brings the emulators and the ROMs all together.
Oh, I see.
So then you'll have like a menu for NES and then SNES. And then you choose your game, and then it just launches.
Got it.
Yeah, but connecting all that stuff can be tricky.
Okay.
So if you're not a super techie guy, but there's plenty of tutorials out there.
And then obviously getting hold of the ROMs is a whole different world.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw one YouTuber actually made a video of where to get your ROMs, which, I don't know, if his channel blows up, Nintendo will shut him down. But
well, I suspect, I don't know this, but there's obviously a lot of abandonware ROMs. where it's perfectly legal to distribute them? Or am I wrong about that?
Yes, there are. I don't know huge amounts of the legal stuff, but I know that some of the ROMs aren't available on Switch or whatever because of licensing issues. Like, for instance, Nintendo would license a game with another game developer.
Oh, no, you're not
going to
get any Nintendo
developer games
freely distributable, I'm sure. I mean, you'll find them on pirate sites, but not legally is what I'm...
Yes. So, for instance, these guys, Anbanic, they ship them with games on them, which is...
Yeah,
I don't know. It's shipping out of China, so maybe that's how they get around it. But they very carefully don't ship it with any like Super Mario or any of those games because I think they'd get
the crap sued out of them.
Yeah, yeah. So cool. That's why I like the Retroid Pocket 3 Plus because it's it ships with no games and you just have to set it up yourself.
Okay,
it's a bit more ethical.
Probably, yeah.
Then you use the ROMs that you own.
Well, I was recently traveling in Turkey and I went to a market where there was a guy selling refurbed Game Boys. And he also had tons of cartridges
that's
available.
That's quite a big thing.
So I almost did that because, that console was just such a thing when I was a kid. I couldn't afford one and I wanted one for so long.
The DMG.
Actually, I think the Game Boy, was it called the Game Boy Pocket or the Game Boy Mini? That was the one.
The Pocket.
Yeah, the battery life was great, and you could use all your original Game Boy cartridges, obviously. I had a GBA as well, which was
amazing. They improved on a few things.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, the most ethical way to do this is go and get hold of the original consoles, I suppose, but those can be gold.
Original hardware.
Yeah.
Which is,
and getting hold of the cartridges is also difficult. Yeah.
I'm always shopping on Facebook Marketplace, but it's getting few and far between these days. I mean, it's there, but a lot of it has become controlled by like guys that have started a shop and they're selling them, but they're reselling them.
Right.
So that bumps the price up. And now because the demand has gotten higher or the supply has gotten lower, the prices are going up. So
Anyway,
I think emulation will end up just kind of taking over.
Makes sense.
Yeah. I'll send you a link.
Cool. Please do.
The Retroid Pocket 3 Plus.
Nice.
Cool, man. Thanks so much, Simon. I really appreciate it. To anyone watching, just click on the links below, check out his books and all the things, and we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks, dude. That was an incredible amount of fun.
Cool.